to show either a negative PCR test or proof that they have been fully vaccinated to avoid having to self-isolate. From Wednesday, 30th of June, the Balearics will be on the UK government's green list of countries from which travellers will not need to quarantine when they return home. But for travellers from the United Kingdom who have had both doses of an approved vaccine, the prospect of a relatively normal summer break appears brighter, with popular destinations loath to shut the doors on those who are unlikely to be infectious. According to the latest data, 61.9% of UK adults are now fully vaccinated, and 84.4% have had at least a first dose of the vaccine. The German government, which has enforced a 14-day quarantine on all tourists from Britain since 26th of May, is yet to convince countries more dependent on tourism that stringent quarantine requirements on all travellers from the United Kingdom are necessary. The prospects for the fully vaccinated appeared all the better on Monday as it emerged that talks were advancing well on the mutual recognition of an NHS app and the European Union's Green Digital Certificate, ensuring that travellers can prove their status. The apps allow border controls to scan a QR code to confirm the vaccination status of the traveller and provide free passage. A European Commission spokesperson said there are talks ongoing at the technical level which are progressing well and going in the right direction. This is particularly because the technical system architecture of the European Union and the United Kingdom are aligned. The talks are ongoing. I have no specific timeline to announce. It's good that the United Kingdom is now working with us towards that goal. A UK government spokesperson said unlocking international travel was vitally important and that officials were seeking to ensure certification is introduced in a way that works for everyone. There are concerns in the UK government that a two-tier system is emerging in which those who are unvaccinated face a disadvantage in trying to get away for a holiday. But owing to the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, that outcome appears unavoidable. At a meeting of a group of European Union diplomats coordinating the Union's integrated political crisis response on Monday, a briefing from the bloc's Disease Prevention and Control Agency noted the highly transmissible nature of the Delta variant. Diplomats were told that the variant will probably account for 90% of cases by the end of August. The rate of vaccination, however, offers hope that the link between infection and hospitalization and deaths will be broken in time. Diplomatic sources said it was likely that the level of infection would in future not be the key factor in deciding whether non-essential travel from the United Kingdom or elsewhere by the unvaccinated is permitted. Sources said the German representative at the meeting said Berlin would be tightening its policy on UK travellers. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel warned fellow leaders at a summit last week that the bloc was not doing well in relation to restricting the spread of variants found in non-EU countries.
The United States says it carried out deadly airstrikes on the positions of Iraq Popular Mobilization units on both sides of the border with Syria on Sunday. Washington claimed their strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The attack drew angry reactions from Iraq and Syria. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Syria, for its part, also condemned in strongest terms the U.S. flagrant oppression in the Syrian-Iraqi border region, describing it as a blatant violation of the sanctity of the Syrian and Iraqi territories.
We have to understand instability is the goal. This is when a war cannot necessarily be won, the invader, the attacker, the aggressor can sort of make the next best thing in their interest, and that is for the war to be constant, the market to be permanent, never ending, the chaos to rule supreme, the strategy of chaos, which is that you destabilize a region to such an extent that they will have no choice but to accept your continued presence. This is something that we've seen in Afghanistan as well. How many times has NATO decided and said and promised that they were going to pull back? Now it looks like the Americans are finally going to pull back, but it is really a wait-and-see sort of thing.
Syria says the latest U.S. attack once again showed the recklessness of Washington's policies and the need for Washington to withdraw its aggressor forces from the region. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. But the U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order.
Again, fortunately, this sort of psychological operation hasn't exactly succeeded, because despite everything, the Iraqis definitely, and the Syrians as well, they still don't want U.S. boots on the ground. They want all Americans out. Doesn't matter what the alternative is. They don't want these imperialist invaders to keep occupying their land. But this is what the Americans keep on trying, and this is exactly why they make up these stupid excuses with which to attack and destroy not the terrorists, but the people who fight against the terrorists, because they try to make it almost in an Orwellian way. They try to switch around the definitions and blame the people who are defending their country for terrorism, while they start to portray the terrorists as quote-unquote freedom fighters, or, you know, people who are moderate rebels fight for democracy like they did in Syria.
The PMU was formed by popular volunteer forces in 2014 after the Daesh terror group launched a campaign of bloodshed and destruction against Iraq. The group played a major role in pushing back and ultimately defeating the terrorist forces, which had taken control of large swathes of the Arab country. Apart from the United States, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
Inhumane sanctions imposed on Iran by the West and the U.S. have hampered the country's efforts to purchase vaccines. The sanctions not only targeted the Iranian oil and banking sector, but also hit pharmaceutical companies and are in violation of the U.N. Charter. Meanwhile, the United States has recently issued a guide to pave the way for the delivery of masks, respirators, and vaccines to countries subject to severe sanctions, such as Iran. That's 16 months after the beginning of the pandemic, when the Islamic Republic has made its vaccine and over 82,000 Iranians have died from the coronavirus. The Islamic Republic has managed to join the few countries around the world developing vaccines to fight the coronavirus disease by producing its first domestic COVID-19 vaccine, known as Coviran Barakat. Iran will focus on using three locally made COVID-19 vaccines, including Russia's Sputnik V and a vaccine jointly produced with Cuba named Pasteur-Covac vaccine. Iran has also launched the clinical trial of yet another vaccine, dubbed Nura, as part of its drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. Iran is also participating in the COVAX scheme. That's why the United Nations had previously slammed the group of seven wealthy nations for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19. For months, the United States, Britain, and Canada practiced vaccine hoarding, even as poorer nations elsewhere had yet to even distribute doses to their medical workers on the front lines of the pandemic. The U.S., its European allies, and their sanctions regime have targeted ordinary Iranian citizens who are facing one of the worst global health crises. Meanwhile, Iran has managed to develop local vaccines amid cruel sanctions and is prepared to mass-produce jabs to provide the world.
Firstly, it says that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a moral medical obligation. It's actually not necessarily trying to profiteer from this vaccine, as with the Pfizer and other vaccines, which are charging very high rates even here. They're making money out of it. It's basically big business. The Islamic Republic of Iran, clearly at something like $8 a shot, isn't profiteering, and I think that, in a way, is one thing which is very positive. The other thing it says about Iran is that it has an ability to do things itself. This advancement in medical fields, in technological fields, scientific fields, bodes very well for Iran's future. It's not relying on the West.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, received his first dose of the Coviran Barakat vaccine on Friday. Coviran Barakat vaccine was approved for emergency mass application by the country's health ministry earlier this month. Before receiving his first dose of the Coviran Barakat vaccine, the leader had set two prior conditions. First, insisting not to receive the vaccine outside the schedule that had been devised for the rest of the Iranians, and second, required to receive only Iranian vaccines. After receiving the jab, the leader thanked all those who were involved in the development of the homegrown vaccine. He said there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he noted that he did not want to use a non-Iranian vaccine. That marked the leader's trust in Iranian scientists and his support for domestic production.
I think the first thing it says is that Ayatollah Khamenei himself is demonstrating his approval of this vaccine, and he's showing that he's leading by example in order to instill confidence, one would assume, within the populace as a whole. On the other hand, he's also making it very clear that this vaccine is one that he's accepted because it's produced by the Islamic Republic of Iran, independent of all others.
Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and it started to be mass-produced on March 29. That placed Iran among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. Under the hardest sanctions, Iran managed to produce its homegrown vaccine. Once again, Iranian scientists proved that nothing is impossible for the Iranian nation, as their will is strong enough to overcome any hardships, including sanctions. Years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million has fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians. The U.S. has targeted Syria with economic sanctions that have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the U.S. and European countries had banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the government of President Bashar Assad, a move that has caused more instability. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria, without any authorization from the Damascus government or a UN mandate. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the US and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. One example is the US aid operation into Idlib. The Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad has said the US push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Syria's Idlib is aimed at supplying terrorist groups and prolonging the war. Meanwhile, Iran has once again underlined the need for a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis.
We reiterate once more that the Syrian crisis must be settled peacefully and in accordance with principles of international law, particularly respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal or external affairs, and peaceful settlement of international disputes.
Majid Tahrawanchi said the current situation in Syria is the result of foreign intervention as well as Israeli aggression. He warned that these issues can negatively impact regional stability and global peace and security. Damascus is determined to restore its sovereignty over the country's entire expanse. The Assad government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. Nevertheless, the presence of U.S. and European forces, in addition to Turkish troops, has slowed down its advances.
And President Assad has been on the forefront of the struggle against U.S. imperialism in the region. For many years, the U.S. has sought to dislocate, dismember, destabilize the Syrian nation. We saw this in 2011 through 2015, 2016, some of the roughest years of the U.S. funding Western-backed terrorists, Wahhabis trained and armed and funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Bashar Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war on Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, Joy Hood, warned countries in West Asia against restoring ties with Syria. He also warned the prospect of sanctions against countries that normalize relations with Syria and do business with Damascus. Hood noted that the only way to achieve stability in Syria is through a political process. He also stated that Washington is committed to working with allies, partners, and the UN to ensure that a durable political solution remains within reach. That's why Washington and its allies are inside Syria without the invitation of the Damascus government or a UN mandate.
One of the biggest techniques of US imperialism is to create chaos and destabilization in a country that is anti-imperialist, that is against the empire, that defends its people. They create chaos there, and then they blame that chaos and destabilization on the policies of that government.
Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad called Washington's policy pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country. Maqdad further accused Western countries of killing Syrian people with their sanctions. Like it or not, Washington and its allies have failed to oust Bashar Assad, and his government is supported by the Syrian people. The presence of foreign forces in Syria is illegal and must end, as it is the root of instability in the country.
Tensions in the Black Sea are on the rise after a British Navy warship breached Russian territorial waters off the Crimean coast on Wednesday. Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that Russia's Black Sea Fleet and the Russian Federal Security Service had stopped the violation of the state border by the British destroyer HMS Defender off Crimea's Cape Fiolin. According to the ministry, the British military vessel ventured 3 kilometers into Russian territorial waters, prompting a Russian border guard patrol ship to fire warning shots and a Sukhoi-24M bomber to drop bombs in front of the destroyer. Following the warning maneuvers, the HMS Defender left the waters, but the British side denied that warning shots had been fired and that any bombs had been dropped in the path of the HMS Defender. Earlier in the day, Russia said hostile actions by the British warship near Russian territorial waters could not have been carried out without the U.S. green light.
I mean, in the sense that the U.S. and the U.K. are sending their fleet far away from home and obviously making provocative actions that are directly related to their interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine, yes, of course, the United States and the U.K. are guilty of these kinds of unwarranted provocations intended to create pressure on Russia. However, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of incidents are relatively common, and they can be expected. What the only unusual part here is that Russia is not backing down and is not giving in to the British pressure.
Russia has warned that it will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Russia's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to strongly protest what it called the British ship's violation of its territory. The ministry said it delivered a strongly worded protest to the envoy over the British Navy ship's, quote, provocative and dangerous actions. It said London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, however, defended the Navy ship's decision to navigate inside the Russian waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we did.
Earlier this month, Russia announced a plan to boost its military presence along its western borders to counter increased NATO activities there. In the meantime, NATO has pressed ahead with its military drills near the Russian ground and maritime borders, a move that Moscow deems provocative.
The frequency with which the NATO, you know, let's refer to the United States and the UK as the key NATO powers, the frequency at which they are doing this and the directness of their approach. There's no pretend here that there was an accident. This is an intentional heightening of military tensions, and it is intentional.
It appears that another Cold War between Russia and the West is likely to be on the horizon. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
U.S. citizens derive no benefit but instead suffer great loss from endless war in the West Asia region. But their interests are irrelevant to decisions of bipartisan Washington, says Glenn Greenwald, journalist, in an article titled "Biden's Lawless Bombing of Iraq and Syria Only Serves the Weapons Industry Funding Both Parties." Stay tuned for more. For the second time in 5 months since he was inaugurated, President Joe Biden ordered a U.S. bombing raid on Syria, and for the first time, he also bombed Iraq. The rationale offered was the same as Biden's first air attack in February. Embedded in this formulaic Pentagon statement is so much propaganda and so many euphemisms that by itself, it reveals the fraudulent nature of what was done. Embedded in this Pentagon statement is so much propaganda and so many euphemisms that by itself, it reveals the fraudulent nature of what was done. To begin with, how can U.S. airstrikes carried out in Iraq and Syria be defensive in nature? How can they be an act of self-defense? Nobody suggests that the targets of the bombing campaign have the intent or the capability to strike the U.S. homeland itself. Neither Syria nor Iraq is a U.S. colony or American property, nor does the U.S. have any legal right to be fighting wars in either country. Rendering the claim that its airstrikes were defensive and an act of self-defense to be inherently deceitful. The Pentagon's description of the people bombed by the U.S. is intended to obscure the reality. The targets of U.S. aggression were Iraqis in their own country and Syrians in their own country. Only the U.S. war machine and its subservient media could possibly take seriously the Biden administration's claim that the bombs they dropped on people in their own countries were defensive in nature. Beyond the propagandistic justification is the question of legality. Though even to call it a question dignifies it beyond what it merits. There is no conceivable congressional authorization, none, zero, to Biden's dropping of bombs in Syria. Obama's deployment of CIA operatives to Syria and years of the use of force to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad never had any congressional approval of any kind, nor did Trump's bombing of Assad's forces, urged by Hillary Clinton, who wanted more. Nor does Biden's bombing campaign in Syria now. It was and is purely lawless and illegal. And the same is true of bombing Iraq. The 2002 authorization to use military force, AUMF, in Iraq, which the House just voted to repeal, has long since ceased to provide any legal justification for ongoing U.S. troop presence and bombing campaigns in that country. In its statement justifying the bombing raids, Biden's Pentagon barely even bothered to pretend any of this is legal. Those claims are nothing short of a joke. Nobody seriously believes that Joe Biden has congressional authority to bomb Syria and Iraq. As the Daily Beast's longtime war on terror reporter Spencer Ackerman put it, discussions of legality at this point are parody. Because when it comes to the U.S. endless wars in the name of the so-called war on terror, we passed lawful behind many, many years ago. Authorization citations are just pretexts written by lawyers who need to pantomime at lawfulness. The U.S. presence in Syria is blatantly illegal. Such things never stop the U.S. This is exactly right. The U.S. government is a lawless entity. It violates the law, including its own constitution, whenever it wants. The requirement that no wars be fought absent congressional authority is not some ancillary bureaucratic annoyance, but was completely central to the design of the country. Article 1, Section 8 could not be clearer. The Congress shall have power to declare war. So why does the U.S. continue to have a military presence in Iraq and Syria? What conceivable benefits redound to American citizens from the massive expenditures required to keep U.S. troops stationed in these two countries, the risk of those troops' lives, the endless acquisition of bombs and other weapons to fight there, and the obvious but severe dangers from triggering escalation with powerful militaries that, unlike the U.S., actually have a vital interest in what makes and takes place in their bordering countries? While the ordinary American only suffers from all of this, there are definitely some sectors of U.S. society which benefit. The corporation that Biden's Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, left in order to run the Pentagon, Raytheon, needs ongoing troop deployment and permanent warfare for its profitability. According to New York Times, it was Defense Secretary Lloyd J. Austin III and General Mark A. Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who briefed Mr. Biden to attack options early last week, after which Biden approved striking the three targets. So General Austin's colleagues on the Raytheon Board of Directors, as well as his comrades on the boards of General Dynamics and Boeing, are surely thrilled with this attack. Indeed, anyone invested in endless war in the West Asia North Africa region, including the entire U.S. intelligence community and the weapons industry which feeds off it, must be thrilled by all of this. It also creates a never-ending supply of angry people in that region who hate the U.S. for bringing death and destruction to their countries with bombs that never stop falling and therefore want to strike back. What we are all supposed to call terrorism. That is what endless war means. A war that is designed never to terminate. One that is as far removed as possible from actual matters of self-defense and manufactures its own internal rationale to continue it. But what is beyond doubt is that this is illegal. Endless war in the West Asia, North Africa region does nothing but harm American citizens, as they are told that they cannot enjoy a sustainable, let alone quality standard of living without working 2 or 3 dreary hourly wage benefit free job for corporate giants. And while more Americans than ever continue to live at home and remain financially unable to start families, the U.S. continues to spend more on its military than the next 13 countries combined. This has continued for close to 2 full decades now because the establishment wings of both parties support it. Neither of them believes the Constitution or the rule of law, nor do they care in the slightest about the interests of anyone other than the large corporate sectors that fund the establishment wings of both parties The bombs that fell on Syria and Iraq were for them and them alone.
The World with Reporters. The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions, and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, in an airstrike near Baghdad Airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
The 10th session of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union, hosted by the Iranian broadcaster, the IRIB. The event brought together representatives of 300 television and radio channels from 33 member states who attended the event through video conference. This year, the session was held with the motto of media justice and freedom of speech.
The 10th General Assembly of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union comes as the websites of several of its affiliated media outlets were seized by the U.S. government, something which the union views as an attempt to silence dissenting voices.
Last week, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation confiscated the websites of Press TV and three dozen other Iranian and regional media outlets for what it described as a means to combat disinformation. Addressing the ceremony in Tehran, head of the IRIB, Abdul Ali Ali Askari, condemned the U.S. move as an open violation of freedom of expression, calling it a failed attempt to muzzle the truth.
The extent of the effectiveness of resistance media outlets prompted the U.S. government to breach its own norms regarding free speech and take down those media. So this shows that those media have been successful. But the West must know that their move indicates their weakness, and on the other hand, the seized media will not stop working.
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union is a multinational entity, which is currently comprised of 228 member media outlets from 33 countries, covering a total of 22 different languages. The main goal of the union is to break the Western monopoly on media and to offer an alternative narrative for regional and global developments, as opposed to the narrative presented by mainstream media. The union says the West has engaged itself in a full-scale media war to silence the alternative voices.
The slogan of freedom of expression is just a tool for the West to impose its will on different countries.
Those media outlets that speak the truth and enlighten the minds of the world nations face censorship just because they expose truths that come at the expense of Western interests.
Head of the IRIB World Service, Peyman Jebeli, says the West can no longer pull the plug on the resistance media since they have already reached global audience, including Western societies.
This time, we witnessed global solidarity with the people of Palestine in their resistance against Israel. Hundreds of thousands of people in Chicago, London, and elsewhere in the West voiced their support for Palestinians. Does the U.S. think it can prevent the voices of Palestine resistance from reaching America by blocking our media outlets?
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union says any attempt by the West to take down independent media is doomed to failure, and they will continue to shed light on the truth. However, member media outlets say they will sue the U.S. for its illegal media crackdown and will take measures to restore the seized websites. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Britain has a new man in charge of the country's health service. Former Chancellor Sajid Javid replaces Matt Hancock to helm the most under-pressure department in government. First point of order, attempting to manage the COVID crisis.
I want to see the restrictions lifted and life going back to normal as quickly as possible. And that's right here and now, that is my absolute priority.
But this is no ordinary cabinet reshuffle. Previous Health Minister Matt Hancock was forced to step down after embarrassing revelations about his private conduct were made public.
I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Despite presiding over the shambolic handling of Britain's COVID response, it became clear that Hancock had fallen out of favour inside Downing Street.
I think it's really likely he was pushed. The exact provenance of the CCTV footage from within his office is not clear, but it's clear that it would be very hard to access that if you weren't in some way strongly connected to the government. So if Boris didn't want him to go, someone did very much. Quite clear that his position was no longer tenable.
For those hoping there'd be a change in approach from the new health chief, they may well be disappointed.
There is no ideological difference between Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. It's a new face, just as Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt became an absolutely figure of hate while he was presiding over the NHS, precisely because he was implementing these ongoing privatisation policies. We're living with the consequences of the NHS being driven into the ground. We've seen unprecedented, really corruption, giving away, gifting tens and hundreds of billions during this pandemic. Sajid Javid, I have no doubt, will continue in the same line.
Britain's National Health Service was already creaking at the seams even before the pandemic. And for the millions who've been waiting to see a medical professional, well, they won't mind who is in charge of the health service. They just want to be made better, and made better soon. With COVID dominating the health agenda, Sajid Javid will have his work cut out for him. And as the fate of his two predecessors has shown, landing the top job is the easy part. Amina Taylor, London.
Rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran, attended this gathering in Tehran to mark the American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion aims to shed light on the U.S.'s record of rights violations in Iran.
We're marking the American Human Rights Week to review the numerous cases where the U.S. openly violated human rights in our country, like the American Navy's downing of our passenger plane in 1988, after which the perpetrators received a badge of honor in the U.S. The latest crime the U.S. has committed was to assassinate the spearhead of the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani.
The second day of the week-long occasion marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti.
Iran says it has lost over 17,000 people in terrorist attacks. 12,000 of them were killed at the hands of the formidable MKO terrorist group. What's even more shocking is that the U.S. does not regard the MKO as a terrorist entity. and has even established intimate ties with them.
The U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials.
Members of U.S. Congress regularly meet MKO leaders where they offer any kind of support to the terrorist group. The U.S. is still supporting the terrorists in their anti-Iran campaigns. The MKO killed our top nuclear scientists, and that was not possible without the U.S. and Israel's assistance.
I lost my husband in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Central Office by the MKO. Interestingly, the spearhead of the terrorist operation, whose real name is Ali Mohtamed, took refuge in the Netherlands, and they welcomed him until a few years ago when the MKO disposed of him as a lost cause.
The American Human Rights Week started on June 27th, which marks the anniversary of the failed assassination of the then Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981, and will end on July the 3rd, which coincides with the anniversary of the U.S. Navy's shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988. Organizers of the occasion say the ultimate goal of the week-long ceremonies is to expose the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Farmers, traders, and exporters of agricultural crops held a demonstration in front of the United Nations headquarters in Gaza to deliver the representative of the United Nations a protest letter against new restrictions imposed by Israel to export Palestinian agricultural crops like vegetables. Israeli closure of borders has led to a huge damage in the agricultural sector of the Gaza Strip.
We have come here to protest against Israeli closure of borders. We want to sell our products in the West Bank and other parts of the world. Israel intends to ruin our lives by adopting such restrictive measures. We call on all human rights organizations to do something.
Palestinian farmers are facing serious financial losses due to the Israeli closure of borders. This is viewed in Gaza as part of a larger plan by Israel to destroy Palestinian economy. Palestinian farmers called on the international community to be committed to its responsibilities and pressurize Israel into opening the borders.
Israel's new restrictive measures will ruin our crops before they reach the target markets. All of our vegetables are stuck here and eventually destroyed. I'm standing here to protest these restrictions that have made our lives unbearable. We demand opening of the borders so we can export our products. This blockade is inhumane.
Along with the Israeli ban on export, the latest aggression on the Gaza Strip has doubled the damage in agricultural sector. This has led to severe losses in this sector as Palestinian farmers can barely afford the living.
Our message to the United Nations is that Israel's measures are aimed to deteriorate life of all Palestinian farmers and traders. The latest Israeli aggression has inflicted a heavy blow on the agricultural sector. Israeli restrictions have no purpose but to ruin the agricultural sector of Gaza.
Due to the Israeli ban on the exportation of goods, the prices for agricultural products in Gaza have dropped significantly. Palestinian farmers and traders here say that the Israeli restrictions imposed on exporting crops aim to destroy the Palestinian economy. They call on the international community to end these restrictions and open the borders. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Demonstrations against Palestinian Authority over the death of Nizar Banat, an activist and outspoken critic of the PA, keep going on across the occupied West Bank. In the city of Ramallah, these protests turned violent as the protesters who began to march to presidential compound faced a group of PA president's security officers in plain clothes. The forces blocked the rally, chased and attacked the protesters who were chanting slogans against the PA and its president. Palestinian security forces in riot gear fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Palestinian factions condemned the use of force against the protesters, saying people have the right to peacefully protest.
The people see that the investigation is slow and that the Palestinian Authority has not yet condemned the killing of Nizar Banat. So people are taking to the streets to ensure those behind Banat's death are put on trial.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtayi said an investigation was launched to investigate Banat's death. Palestinians are demanding a swift, independent, and a transparent investigation. Palestinian rights group made an initial autopsy, saying that Banat took blows to the head, and the wounds indicated an unnatural death.
We need to take some practical steps within law that require justice, investigation, and accountability for those behind Nizar Banat's death. We say there is a need to dismiss this government as well as the heads of the security forces.
Journalists were also attacked by security forces during the protests. The Palestinian Journalists Union decried the grave development in the attack on freedom of expression and the media. Journalists, meanwhile, say condemnation is not enough. They say the attack is unacceptable and should be investigated in order to hold those responsible accountable.
Commentators say that what's going on today is only the tip of the iceberg. They say if the Palestinian Authority wants to prevent a possible collapse, it should bring those perpetrators into justice and allow people to freely protest and express their opinion. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Children and armed conflict in Yemen 2021 was the title of the recent report of the Secretary General of the United Nations. In a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights, Yemen government discussed the UN report and how children protection could be achieved.
For years now, we have been used to see the United Nations doing the opposite of what it should do regarding the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. This report in itself is considered a war crime against the children of Yemen. It was clear from the first day of the war in Yemen that the United Nations seeks to legitimize war and crimes.
The ministry said the report of the United Nations is full of inaccuracies and doesn't rely on any investigation on the ground, adding that the report aims to legitimize the Saudi war crimes against Yemeni children.
The most serious inaccuracy in the recent United Nations report is that it zeroed the number of crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition countries and did not mention any of their crimes. Unfortunately, the United Nations accused the Yemeni army of targeting more than 7,000 children, and these numbers are incorrect. The United Nations didn't explain where it has got these statistics from.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. During the war years, Riyadh has committed numerous violations of international law, including using internationally prohibited weapons in its air raids, which have killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
Besides the ongoing Saudi siege that prevents millions of Yemenis, including children, from getting food, medicine, and fuel, Saudi airstrikes have also killed more than 4,000 Yemeni children alone, according to rights organizations. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana.
Demonstrations against Palestinian Authority over the death of Nizar Banat, an activist and outspoken critic of the PA, keep going on across the occupied West Bank. In the city of Ramallah, these protests turned violent as the protesters who began to march to presidential compound faced a group of PA president's security officers in plain clothes. The forces blocked the rally, chased and attacked the protesters who were chanting slogans against the PA and its president. Palestinian security forces in riot gear fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Palestinian factions condemned the use of force against the protesters, saying people have the right to peacefully protest.
The people see that the investigation is slow and that the Palestinian Authority has not yet condemned the killing of Nizar Banat. So people are taking to the streets to ensure those behind Banat's death are put on trial.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtayi said an investigation was launched to investigate Banat's death. Palestinians are demanding a swift, independent, and a transparent investigation. Palestinian rights group made an initial autopsy, saying that Banat took blows to the head, and the wounds indicated an unnatural death.
We need to take some practical steps within law that require justice, investigation, and accountability for those behind Nizar Banat's death. We say there is a need to dismiss this government as well as the heads of the security forces.
Journalists were also attacked by security forces during the protests. The Palestinian Journalists Union decried the grave development in the attack on freedom of expression and the media. Journalists, meanwhile, say condemnation is not enough. They say the attack is unacceptable and should be investigated in order to hold those responsible accountable.
Commentators say that what's going on today is only the tip of the iceberg. They say if the Palestinian Authority wants to prevent a possible collapse, it should bring those perpetrators into justice and allow people to freely protest and express their opinion. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
On June 25, 1950, the Korean War broke out as the North Korean army poured across the 38th parallel into South Korea. The anniversary Friday provided a marker for reflection. The war memorial here in the center of the South Korean capital is part of ongoing multifaceted efforts to promote the military. Here, honoring those who served and died in the Korean War, South Koreans, Americans, and other nationalities. But the 1950-53 conflict was only suspended with an armistice, not a peace treaty. And because of the tension with North Korea, South Korea requires all able-bodied men to serve a year and a half in the armed forces. More and more South Koreans are not buying into the rhetoric of militaristic antagonism. Activist Shin Jae-uk this week launched an online museum, a group effort exposing disturbing aspects of the Korean War with previously restricted material.
The War Memorial Hall was established in the name of patriotism education to extol anti-communist ideology. It is centered on generals and heroes, not ordinary soldiers or civilians, and is belligerent about war and glorifies it.
Documents in the exhibit confirm the U.S. military's use of napalm in the Korean War and suspicions that a South Korean general destroyed a bridge across the Han River, preventing thousands of civilians from retreating.
This exhibit is about the stories of people who are hidden behind the ideology that national security is most important. It comes from the perspective of war victims. We want to let people know that war is not allowed, and there is no just war in the world. And when war breaks out, people are forced to die this way.
Some 2.3 million people were killed during the Korean War, often called the Forgotten War or the Never-Ending War. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality.